Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure tonight to introduce Rebecca Costa, an interviewer for the Costa Report and also the author of The Watchman's Rattle, A Radical New Theory of Collapse. I just love this quote from the New York Journal of Books. In chapter after chapter, Costa challenges conventional wisdom. Highly recommended. Those of you who have been following what I do here, I only had to see that and say, okay, she's got to come and talk. So without further ado, and these books are available afterwards, Rebecca Costa.
Can you hear me okay, everybody? All right. I'm not as tall as you. I realized that as I was sitting there looking up. Just by a show of hands, I don't ask a lot of questions throughout the presentation, but I'd like to just start with one because I think it will sort of bring us all together and give us a context. And that is, and please just raise your hand and keep it up in the air because it'll be a moment for us. How many people sitting here today have noticed that just even in the last 5 years, things have started to get a lot more complicated and difficult to understand? Okay, so keep your hands in the air and now look around because this is your free therapy for tonight. It is not you. And for the longest time, my children had me convinced that it was just me getting older. And then one day I got into an elevator and there was a young gal there, I don't know, maybe 18, 20 years old, and she had her smartphone out. She says, "How do you turn this off and make the music stop?" And I went, "Nope, not me, not me." Right? So it might interest you to know that Verizon now has a new phone out that will take up to 200,000 apps. Okay, so I'm an evolutionary biologist, and let me tell you, I don't want that phone, and you can't handle 200,000 of anything. I don't want any more new apps. In fact, we're so disconnected these days from our biological origins and our biological limitations as humans. And we somehow think we're going to keep up with all these gadgets and all these things. I had a guy come up to me just after a speech I made 2 weeks ago and say that he just bought the new Lexus. And he said, they don't give you an owner's manual anymore. It's really cool. You just go online and you look for what you want. But he said, but I'm like a newspaper guy. I like to have the manual. So I decided to download it. It was 780 pages. I had to keep filling up the tray, the printing tray, with paper. And he said, 780 pages. He goes, I wonder what the mechanics manual looks like. He had a good point. But, you know, those are some funny examples. But let's ratchet it up to some really serious examples. Do any of you remember General McChrystal putting up that really large chart about the size of this backdrop that showed all these arrows, and he got up at a press conference and he said, when we understand this diagram, we win the war in Afghanistan. Do you remember that? Well, for just a split moment, CNN was covering the press conference, and for just a split moment, the camera went back to all the news reporters and they put their pens down and you saw them going, it was priceless. It was priceless because they were all thinking, oh no, we can't win then. Because we don't understand that chart, and we're not capable of understanding that chart. Then he got fired, and I think it was the chart, right? But by the way, you can Google the chart. Just Google General McChrystal chart, and you'll see that chart. And I challenge everybody listening to me to explain it to me, right? And as a matter of fact, I had the opportunity on my radio program, which is syndicated across the country, and I'm on with a global leader every week. I had the opportunity to interview Carl Eikenberry, ambassador to Afghanistan. And I asked him about that chart. And he said, you can't believe it when you become an ambassador to a place like in Afghanistan. You get there and there's 3 days where they're showing you charts and binders and everything. And this is our campaign to win the war. And he says, and as soon as they left, I threw it all to the side and said, can you get Karzai in here so we could just have a conversation? Because that's what was needed. And I mean, the time it would have taken to understand all that would have just been impossible. Now, I'm a sociobiologist, and so when we have consternation like this, the first thing I do is I go back to the human organism itself, what we are and what we are not. And I like to be brutally honest about what we are not. So we're in for a little bit of a ride today. The first thing I want to tell you is every country on the entire planet has the same problems we have here in America. They're dealing with climate change, terrorism, illegal immigration. Go into Paris, France. They've got an immigration problem there. They've got immigration problems everywhere. Why? Because the largest migration of humans in the history of mankind is taking place right now, from rural areas to urban areas. So the fact that we're having an immigration problem doesn't surprise me. In fact, it should occur to us that if every nation who has different economic systems and different political systems is having the same problem, then maybe it's a species-wide problem, right? I mean, it should dawn on us. Now, my slides went off because of complexity. We're going to talk about complexity, but you know what? This is where George is my best friend. He will help me with technology. We have to type this in. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to type this in, and we're going to continue. That's right. Okay, we'll see if this works, and if it comes up, we will all applaud. Nope. We will all applaud madly that technology actually saved the day. 595. You're going, you know, this is a demonstration. This is a live demonstration of Rebecca and her problem with technology. There we go. Okay. All right. So, yay! It worked. All right, so I have a big job today. I'm going to try to convince you that the problems that we're dealing with in corporate America, in our nation's capital, that you and I are dealing with when we get a new car, when we get a new smartphone, are biological. They are not economic, and they are not political. Although, when you watch the news today, you will be convinced that everything that's gone wrong in the world is political or economic, and that it can be solved if we just got better leaders in the White House and if we just made more money. That every problem we have will be fixed by that. But our real problem is complexity. We're up against a limit right now. We manufacture it in picoseconds, and we make new discoveries every minute of every day. But biological change, this spacesuit that you and I are trapped in, that Romney, Biden, Obama, members of Congress, right, the head of the climate change panels, all the experts in the world, we're all kind of stuck with this biological spacesuit. It requires many millions of years to develop new apparatus and new features. In fact, I need new appendages now in my car, because I don't know how to work my nav system, drink my coffee, change my CD player, drive and text. And we're so out of touch with our biological origins that they have to legislate, they have to put a law in place to convince us we can't text and drive a 2-ton vehicle. Really? Really? Now, I'm not big on big government, but I'll tell you, if we can't figure it out, we're going to have somebody tell us that we can't do it. That's the consequence. So I became very interested about 6 or 7 years ago, having been parachuted into the middle of Silicon Valley and seeing technology and complexity start to accelerate. I became really curious about what happens when complexity races ahead of our brain's ability to understand it. And I realized that the earliest symptom that we have prior to collapse is gridlock. We know what our most dangerous problems are. We can name them. Climate change, terrorism, nuclear proliferation, education going down the tubes, pandemic viruses. Everybody's got the same checklist, by the way. We know what they are, and we don't get on top of them. In California, we have a water problem. Everybody knows we've got a water problem, and we have lots of technology and lots of solutions. We could build reservoirs, desal plants. We could let people collect rainwater individually. There's lots of things we could do. We just don't get on top of it. We don't take action. By the way, very important point, we always think we have more time than we do. Because one of the things that the human brain does not do well at this point in evolution is understand exponentiating problems. We get it wrong. We always think that problems are working in a linear mode. So, oops, let's go back. We become unable to fix our problems, and we start passing them from one generation to another as they worsen. It turns out every advanced civilization reaches a biological threshold. One way to think about it is we have two clocks. One clock is the rate at which we progress, and another clock is the rate at which this biology changes and grows new features. One clock, every time the hand moves, it's a picosecond. The other clock, every time the hand moves, it's a million years. So why do we hit a cognitive threshold? There's an uneven rate of change between biology and complexity, and this causes a gap to occur. Now, the last time we had an evolutionary milestone in cognition was when we stood upright, and this was many, many millions of years ago. And the interesting thing is we stood upright, and suddenly we could see and smell our enemies many, many miles away. It was really good for us as a species, but we didn't know what to do with it. We couldn't process that information and say, I should hide, I should run, I should build a weapon, or whatever. So what happened to us is that our brains began to change very, very fast. It's what we call fast evolution. We had a rapid growth of the frontal cortex. The frontal cortex is the CEO of your brain. It makes all the rational and logical decisions and processes the really critical information that makes modern man. It occupies about a third of your brain right now. But that was a special event in evolution. That occurred over 4 or 5 million years, and that was really fast. When civilizations are young, their problems are very simple, and they're easily managed by the left and the right brain and the frontal cortex that we have today. But over time, these problems become larger and more complex. In fact, I would argue that that chart that General McChrystal put up about how to win the campaign in Afghanistan, it looked more like the kinds of problems that physicists deal with. Lots and lots of variables, all acting dynamically in a chaotic model. What physicists deal with is lots of variables, and one variable changes 0.00001%, and all the other variables change at the same time, but not in the same way. And those are more like the kinds of problems that we have in Washington, D.C. today. The more complex a problem becomes, the more we have more wrong choices than we have right choices. So our odds are stacked against us. One way to think of complexity is more wrong choices than right ones, and the wrong ones are exponentially getting larger. So we're hitting a high failure rate environment. According to Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, every 2 days, every 48 hours, we're creating as much information as we did between the dawn of man and 2003. This is what we're creating every minute of every day. It looks like a friendly chart, but it's kind of terrifying, actually. I mean, think about it. 204 million users are sending email messages every minute of every day. Complexity makes facts and knowledge very difficult to acquire. And when this happens, the second symptom prior to collapse, remember the first symptom is gridlock. We know what the problems are. We don't get on top of them. We think we have more time. The second problem is complexity makes facts difficult to get to. So we begin substituting unproven beliefs. Now, I'm going to give you a great example from personal experience. I'm on talk radio, AM talk radio. Anybody listen to AM talk radio? No, you're too smart. You know to stay away from that toxic stuff. Right. I had an opportunity to go on NPR, but I had never listened to talk radio before, but these guys are really talented. I mean, if you've never listened to Rush Limbaugh for 3 hours, I really recommend it. You have to do it. You have to promise me you'll do it because he's really talented. I do not possess his talent. I will tell you that right now because I have a little problem with I like to talk about the facts. He's able to talk 3 hours and not mention a single fact, but it's presented as factual. And sometimes after listening to him, I become so confused. I have to go home and do hours of research because I thought that he said one thing and that it was true. So what is a belief? What is an unproven belief? First of all, it's cognitively inexpensive. When you have to go prove a fact, right, you actually have to, you know, go and get empirical data, do research. Think about scientists. Scientists have beliefs. They're called hypotheses. They just use a different language. So any scientist that tells you religious beliefs terrible, you know, anybody that tells you that, then go, what is a hypothesis? It's every great discovery in science, every great discovery in technology was based on a hypothesis. But you've got to go prove it's right. A belief is easy. You believe it or you don't believe it. End of story. You're done. And we have large beliefs and we have small beliefs. You believe your money is in the bank, right? You deposit it and one day you write a check and it won't be there. right? By the way, you can't have any facts about the future because it hasn't happened yet. Everything you know about the future or think you know about the future is not a fact. That's why we call it the future. Okay? But we have large and small beliefs. So when the traffic light turns green, you think it's okay to walk. You don't stop there generally and wait for every car to stop, right? And you have larger beliefs. You have religious beliefs. It turns out that over human history, you can see that there is a point at which these societies, corporations, organizations are thriving. And when they are thriving, they have made an accommodation for the vigorous pursuit of facts. And also, when the facts dropped off, they accommodated beliefs. And I'm going to give you an example, a safe example, because this is an election year, and I know that, you know, the red states are sitting here and the blue states are sitting here, right? So we're going to talk about an example. But we've had ancient beliefs since the beginning of mankind. You cannot find, by the way, any groups of humans that didn't have beliefs. In ancient times, we drew, little drawings on the cave walls to help us be, the women be more fertile, catch larger prey, protect us from larger enemies. And human civilizations can be proven to thrive when both coexist side by side. By the way, I killed this slide when I did my speaking tour in the South. They were not liking it. So when beliefs dominate, knowledge takes a back seat. And we become very susceptible to manipulation and ideology. Does anybody know who this is? Yeah, I love this picture. He looks so nice. By the way, those people who turned their life savings over to Bernie Madoff, they weren't mom and pops like you and me. These were very sophisticated investors who had been in the marketplace a long time. So if you don't think there's a problem between facts and beliefs, you better ask those people why they turned their life savings over to Bernie Madoff when he was saying it's too complicated. You don't need to understand how I'm making the money. I know. Now, how many times have you been told that, right? But here's the third symptom. Gridlock, substitution of facts and opinions and beliefs. And the third most dangerous sign before collapse is that public policy becomes shaped by irrational beliefs rather than knowledge or fact. And then some cataclysmic event occurs. I'm not really interested in the cataclysmic event that pushes a corporation over a cliff or pushes a country over a cliff. It could be a pandemic virus, a war. I let the historians argue about what really caused Rome to collapse, and they all have different opinions. But the fact is there is a long, slow drive toward that cliff. We now know that every collapse has a precursor, and there are signs along the way. And what is particularly interesting to me as a sociobiologist is why we don't turn the wheel. Because we don't. So let me talk about a safe example, the Mayans. They were around for 3,000 years. They make us look like newcomers. For 3,000 years, the Mayans knew they had a very tenuous relationship with rainfall. They knew if the rains didn't come, they couldn't grow crops and the society could not expand. So for the first 1,500, almost 2,000 years, I know that you've probably been to the Mayan ruins and see the beautiful temples. Forget that. They were phenomenal hydraulic engineers. Unprecedented for their time. I can't even express to you. They developed reservoirs that were much larger than those temples to store water. They dug underground cisterns to keep the water from evaporating. They were the first to discover refrigeration. When food was scarce, they stored it in the cisterns so that it wouldn't spoil. They practiced crop rotation, water conservation. Amazing. They had a wonderful relationship with water. And then the drought kept persisting. And you see a shift away. You see they become gridlocked, and then you see a shift away from fact-based, man-made remedies. They stop building reservoirs. No more use of cisterns. Now, when they're thriving, remember, they're not only building these reservoirs, they're also practicing what? Fetishism. They're making sacrifices. But as the drought persists, they abandon all man-made remedies, and they begin escalating the sacrifices. First, captured slaves. Then they move on to the old and the infirm. Then they move on to young virgins. Nope, drought persists. By this point, there are no remedies that were man-made or rational. Public policy has gone completely berserk. And at the very end, prior to the collapse of the Mayan civilization, they were murdering newborn, unspoiled infants. Now, I've had a lot of people that come up to me and say, yeah, but we're not doing that. No, we're flying airplanes into buildings as an answer to our problems. In my view, personally, not any different. So to summarize, the first sign that complexity is outpacing our brains is gridlock. The second is that we substitute beliefs for knowledge. The third is public policy grows irrational, and then finally collapse ensues. But a gap in cognition isn't the only obstacle that we face. We are not born blank slates. Now, several decades ago, we were told a lie, and we all accepted it. It was that you're born a blank slate, and your mom writes something on it, and your dad writes something on it, and your teachers write something on it, and that's who you become. We completely left evolution and DNA off the map. I don't know how we did that, but we did it. We said, you don't have any instincts, right, and you don't have any drives, and you come with no programming. And it was kind of fascinating that psychologists adopted that and ignored biology. But the vestiges of prehistoric urges that were vital for survival. You know, you are in this room today because your ancestors were superior to the biological losers who didn't make it. Their DNA isn't here. There are biological winners. There are biological losers. That's the way nature operates. But you in this room, somehow your ancestors figured it out. We have lots of biological instincts. Some of us, you won't like this, but we're the descendant of very violent tribes who saw other tribes and murdered them, annihilated them, and that's why our DNA survived. Some of us were greedy, we were hoarders, and so in times of food shortages, we had more food and our DNA survived. Some of us were very prolific reproducers. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Bill Clinton, Elliot Spitzer. You know, we're always surprised. How did they do that? Why did they do that? Why did they do it? Because one of the strongest drives that you're born with is the drive to reproduce and propagate your DNA. Now, I happen to have discovered that I am a descendant of the high-calorie-seeking organism tribe. Me and Oprah. I think Oprah and I are related along those lines. And the reason I know that is because my rational mind knows that I should never eat a donut for the rest of my life. But if you've got a food choice out there and it's celery or carrot sticks and donuts, get out of my way. I'm going for the donut. Right? So I know these things, and apparently I'm not the only one. So recently, and I put these slides in here for a reason. Recently, I was told by somebody, oh, no, I don't accept that I have these primitive urges. And I said, all right, you don't think you have an urge for territoriality? And he said, no, I do not. And I said, okay, let me think for a moment. And then I thought about it, and I said, would you do an experiment for me, sir? And he said, yes. And I said, the next time you're at the grocery store. He said, yes. I said, I'd like you to do me a favor. Why waste your time going up and down the aisles shopping? I want you to get your cart, go straight to the checkout stand, and just shop out of other people's carts. They haven't paid for that food yet. It doesn't belong to them. It's just in their cart. It belongs to the store. So just take your milk, because they'll have everything you need. They'll have milk, bread, eggs. So just take it out of the cart. I said, 10 seconds, the store manager's there, and you're in fisticuffs. Why? Rationally, you know you didn't pay for it. Rationally, you know that someone reaching into your cart, taking that food, is not wrong. It's not illegal, but you feel violated. Why is that? Because territoriality represents the resources necessary for a troop's survival. When you see ants battle, social insects battle, when you see chimpanzees battle for territory, it's because what's necessary for them to survive in that geographic area has to be protected in order for them to continue. And this is my story about the donuts. But apparently I'm not the only person who's acting irrationally. You see any problem with this slide? I love this gym. By the way, what you can't see is all the people lined up, right, in their cars waiting on their cell phones to get a closer parking place to the escalator. That's the part, that's the shot I really wanted to show you, but I don't have it. I love it. They're burning fossil fuels for 10 minutes to get closer so they can get the escalator to go to the gym. The environment is changing very, very quickly, and it is making it very difficult for us to adapt. I think we can all agree on that one point. I love this quote the most. It's from Ed Wilson. We live in a time when we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. And you put all those in a blender, and that's the world we're living in. Don't tell me it's because I'm getting older and I can't figure out my smartphone or how to use my nav system or any other thing. Don't tell me. I know that this has happened to regular Mayans, Romans, people in the Khmer Empire, in the Egyptian Empire. There had to be regular citizens like you or me walking around going, you know, our government doesn't seem to be taking care of this problem anymore. What's going on? There had to be regular citizens that were thinking about that. So I'm not really a gloom and doom person. About this time, usually people are looking for the exit signs. They're going, this is the most depressing presentation I've ever heard. Never invite her back. No, no, I'm a cheerful, optimistic person. You can tell from my book. What do we have today that we could break the cycle? Surely we've invented something. And this got me to thinking about the 5% difference in genome between our nearest ancestors, the bonobo monkey, and ourselves. Because, you know what, with only 5% to work with, I don't know about you folks, but I think we've leveraged the heck out of that. Wow, 5%. The men are not trying to have sex with their chairs. The women are not screaming and throwing food across the table. I mean, it's like, it's amazing. I spend a lot of time with bonobos, and I'm going to tell you, our behavior is fantastic. We develop spaceships. When our environment doesn't suit us, we develop a spaceship and go into outer space. We develop a submarine and go into the deepest depths of the ocean. When we don't like an environment, we just change it. It is absolutely amazing. The importance is not so much the 95% that we share with the bonobos. And believe me, the more time you spend with bonobos, the more similarities you start to see. Just want to say, the 5% is our ability to reason. And within that 5%, the greatest genetic inheritance that only human beings have is the ability to preview the future and take an action today to preempt negative outcomes. Think about it. We can run scenarios. We know what's going to happen. And then we can do something today in the present to head that off. No other animal has this. This is the highest instrument of our genetic inheritance. And yet we squander it. There are two antidotes that I've come up with, but since I wrote the book, people have been sending me suggestions. I can't get to them fast enough. So I want you to know my information is incomplete. And I love that. I love that you can write a book, put it out in the universe, and all these people say, but you forgot this. And I said, wow, that's great. Another second book. Give me the information. It's been fantastic. So we have two things we can work with. Short-term mitigation tactics, right? And long-term, which is fast adaptation. We have to adapt quickly. Now, mitigation is really, I want to explain, we get confused about it. Water conservation is a mitigation. It's not a cure. We all understand this, right? I write about this in my book. We get confused. We think that if we use less and less and less water, that we're solving the water problem. No, here's how you know it's a mitigation. Because when there is no water, there's nothing to conserve. You see? So, water conservation, no. And I have this argument, by the way, the water board hates me in Monterey County. They hate me because they make these proposals and I say, yes, that's a very good short-term mitigation. And then the solution would be, what? Like, let's get to the cure, but we never quite get to it. Now, according to Yanir Baryam, which is out of Harvard University, remember we get back to there are more wrong solutions than right ones in a complex environment. So if there's more wrong solutions, and those are exponentiating, and there are fewer right solutions to pick from, then we enter a high failure rate environment. In other words, you and I become bad pickers. And it's not just us. Experts and leaders become bad pickers as well. So do heads of corporations. So do people that are instrumental at making policy for all of us. Through trial and error, we run the clock out. All the while, conditions are deteriorating. Now, I'm going to give you two examples of good mitigation and bad mitigation. The Gulf oil spill, for example. You do remember the Gulf oil spill. Please say you didn't forget. one of our greatest ecological disasters. So when the Gulf oil spill originally happened, I hope that you'll remember that the first solution that we had was drop a concrete box on the hole. That was our first solution. And then we waited 30 days, and meanwhile, we were watching Hiroshima-looking mushroom clouds coming out of the ocean. And I'm a scientist, but I was looking at it saying, this is like a science fiction movie. Maybe we opened up the earth and can't close it. I don't know. So we put a concrete box on, waited 30 days. It didn't work. Meanwhile, the problem is exponentiating. Then the second solution was we were going to drill from the side and relieve some of the pressure, some of the oil that was going to the surface. And we waited another 30 days, and that didn't work. And then the third solution was static kill. And that held, fortunately. But imagine for a moment if that was solution number 87 or 192. You see, when you have a time-sensitive, mission-critical problem, you cannot deal with it in a linear fashion anymore. So what kind of mitigations really work? Well, we have examples of high failure rates. Venture capital, just south of here on Sand Hill Road, we got venture capitalists that are experts at failure. They're not experts at success, by the way. For every 100 companies they invest in, they only expect 10 or 15 to do well. But they will do so well that they'll overwhelm the losses. So they know no amount of due diligence, no amount of studying a company or a technology any further will improve those odds. And so we have these models for high failure rates, and sometimes we use them. Do you remember the rescue of the Chilean miners? There was a phenomenal example of collaboration and humans rising to their highest calling. We had people trapped, and the Chilean government called in people from all over the world, from Germany, from the United States, geologists, wire experts, all kinds of mining experts. They called them all in, and they began launching 16 rescue plans at the same time. And as they started moving forward, because they knew they couldn't call it, high failure rate environment, remember? So they're going down. Then it turned into 15. Then it turned into 14. At the end, when they rescued the Chilean miners, there were still 2 to 3 plans still going after those miners. And did anyone come back and say, yeah, but you wasted all that money and all that time on those other 14 plans? No, they did not. They were overjoyed that they were successful. My question for citizens in the United States is, are we willing to accept an 80% failure rate if we know it will solve our most dangerous problems? Look what we did with Solyndra. The government has about a 90% positive or neutral investment history in solar energy, and we go after the one that's the loser. And then we wag our finger at everybody and go, the government shouldn't be doing this. Any venture capitalist in the world would be happy with that kind of a track record. Oh, these just get away from me. There's another problem, too, and that is that the drive toward efficiency leads to singularity. We want to save money. So I'm talking to a emergency response group in Illinois right now. Right now, all their emergency response crews are divided up by territories or precincts, but now they're getting ready to centralize into one statewide emergency response because it'll cut labor, right? They can make it more economical, more efficient. But what is going to happen if that system goes down? Today we have redundancy. Sometimes waste is necessary. Corporations have a hard time with this concept. Believe me, I talk to a lot of corporate groups. They don't like me coming in and saying, you got to have some redundancy and some waste. Because if you kill it all, you're driving towards singularity. In nature, the number one rule is any drive towards singularity is a drive toward extinction. When you drive toward a singular global economy, and China and Japan and Germany's markets and the U.S. markets all look the same, what do you think happens when one country has a bad subprime mortgage policy? You take them all down. Before World War II, we had very different economies. But we don't believe in diversification anymore. And here's the reason why, because it makes doing business easier. if doing business and raising capital in China and their stock markets look similar to mine here and in Japan and in India and South America, then I can go everywhere and I can be a global citizen and I can do things easier. But it is not healthy, because when you drive towards singularity, you are driving towards sudden dramatic collapse. This is very important. This is an important concept in a high failure rate environment, and I don't think we understand it. Well, I apologize. My slides just get away from me. This is complexity. I am the living example of complexity. So I gave you some examples: centralized emergency services, globalization. You know what? The next time somebody starts talking to you about globalization, would you do me a favor? Would you say, please don't use the word globalization, use the word homogenization? Because that's what it is. We need to change our language. Homogenization is very dangerous in a high failure rate environment. And corporate consolidation, same kind of thing. There is no one story fits all. So what are the cures? Redundancy. You have to have a certain amount of redundancy, because when one system goes down, you have to have a way to recover. Decentralization. We talk about centralizing the federal government versus returning more power back to the states, the counties, and so on and so forth. Is there any question about this, that would be a better, more efficient system? Not in my mind. Sorry to draw politics in this, but the only way you can get diversification is to get out of centralization and stop letting economics drive every decision we make for governance. We cannot do that. Antidotes to complexity and extinction are redundancy, decentralization, and diversification. And I don't have a lot of time to talk about that. And generally, I do workshops on every single one of those, but not enough time tonight. Mitigations buy us time, but let's be real. Those are short-term fixes. They'll buy us a little time, but the real key is fast adaptation. Do you remember Billy Bean? Did anybody see Moneyball? Oh, I love that movie. I watch it over and over. And I don't like baseball. I don't watch baseball at all. But Billy Bean is my hero, because he understood that if he didn't evolve, he would die and he would be toast. So one of the things that we've discovered, and you know what? This is the first time in human history that this has been available to us, is that we can finally, finally put a skull cap on our heads and administer increasingly complex problems to us and watch and see what's going on under our skulls. See what our brain is really doing. Do you realize that in all of human history, we've never been able to see what our brains were doing? So what we find is that we have left brain problem solving and we have right brain problem solving, but we've discovered a third form of problem solving, and it seems to be ideally suited to highly complex dynamic problems. When you think about this third form of problem solving, you realize that we've made it kind of into folklore. We kind of made stories about it because we weren't willing to accept that each of us had this capability. I'm certainly not going to come up with some major formula in physics, but that's because I don't have enough content regarding physics to be able to do that. But when you think about it, we make stories about Newton, an apple falling on his head and suddenly discovers gravity. And Archimedes sits in a tub and the water flows over and he discovers displacement theory. But what we've discovered now, right here at UCSF Medical Center and the Keck Center, we've discovered that there's a third form of problem solving, and all of us have it. It's not nurture, it's nature. Here's how the brain works. First of all, you have the left side of the brain. And the best way to describe the left side of the brain and how it solves problems, it's like a grocery store where everything is labeled and everything's done alphabetically. All the juices are in one aisle. All the cereals are in another aisle. It's really, really organized. When you're solving a problem using the left side of your brain, you start out with this much information and you keep narrowing it down. You get down to one or two choices and then you pick one. And if that's the wrong one, you switch gears really fast. The right side of your brain uses synthesis. That's more like a showroom. You go into somebody's house and you see a beautiful painting, a candy dish, a magazine, and a chair. They're only related because we organized them that way. Synthesis is sometimes an interpretation. Sometimes when I'm talking to you and you're telling me kind of an elaborate story and it's going on and I notice there's a little perspiration above your lip, I know you're lying to me. By the way, if you don't know this, you're all excellent liar detectors. Do you ever like meet somebody and just like 1 second after you met him, you go, I just don't trust that guy. Anybody raise your hand? I said I wouldn't make you raise your hand again, but I am making you. Yeah. By the way, trust that. Because that's something that you inherited from your prehistoric ancestors. Liars were a threat to your survival. And the reason was because they would take more food than they should. They couldn't be trusted to stand guard outside the cave, so on and so forth. Okay, so the third form of problem solving is you got a big warehouse and you just wish for the thing that you want and only that thing appears. Now, how do we know insight and aha moments are different from left and right brain? Well, one of the ways we know is that it happens suddenly. You make a connection of two pieces of data you have in your head in a novel way that you've never connected them before. This is what insight is. It's actually making a connection of two things. And sometimes, you know, you're sitting around with people and you're trying to solve a problem and somebody goes, I know, this is what we should do. And everyone, have you had this experience where you all turn around and you say, how'd you come up with that? And they go, I don't know. I just thought about it. This is why insight is important. A thriving society uses left and right brain methods to solve problems. And knowledge and beliefs coexist. But then we hit a cognitive threshold. What's the cognitive threshold? It's the capabilities your brain has developed to this point in time. So then our problems start persisting. They grow larger, more dangerous, and beliefs replace knowledge. Super memes appear. I talk about 5 super memes in my book that are appearing right now. What are those? Those are mega beliefs that begin to seize society. Then we collapse and we regenerate. By the way, when the Mayan society collapsed, it didn't mean they all died. It meant that they just dispersed into small groups and they began the ascent again. But what we're discovering now is that insight is developing in each of us. It is the ability to process and manage growing complexity. And if you don't believe me, let me tell you this. This is how fast this is happening. Your grandchildren's brain looks different than yours. It's not the same as yours. And this is unprecedented speed. We don't know what it means. We don't even know if it's sustainable. This is why evolutionary biologists like me are very concerned about increases in autism, ADD, all the increases in depression. Something is happening to the human brain, and it's happening at a rate that we've never seen before. Physiologically, it's happening. So insight, there's a lot of attributes. I'm not going to go into all of them. These are some of the scientific ways that we can tell. But one of the things that we do know is that watching your brain, I can give you a series of problems. You'll use your left brain. You'll use your right brain. You'll be succeeding. And then you'll hit a cognitive threshold and you'll start failing. You'll fail every question in the lab. And then all of a sudden, about 300 milliseconds before you're going to have a breakthrough, a small part of your brain called the ASTG lights up like a Christmas tree. And I can tell you're going to answer that question that's way above your pay grade. Now, if you may not be a scientist, but I'm going to tell you that when you get to a point where you can predict something's going to happen, you're on to something. Now the trick is, how do we induce it? How do we have more insights? How do we make it work more? And that's what we're doing in the labs. If it happens to everyone again, then it's not nurture, it's nature. But here is the key. My kid said, hey mom, I don't have to do homework, I'll just have insights. Wrong. Remember that an insight is connecting two pieces of content in a way that you've never connected them before. And so what is the key? The key now to having insights is you have to load content. And as you know, it's not easy. If you've ever tried at our age to learn a foreign language, case proven, right? All right. So the key is, what do we do to load content better? And I'm going to tell you, if you haven't seen this before, I would encourage you to go to a website called Posit Science, P-O-S-I-T. It's run by Mike Mersnick. He's a neuroscientist over at UCSF. And he was one of the pioneers in brain plasticity. Brain plasticity is how the brain rewires itself when it's damaged. And he thought, and he was right about this, that the brain was probably like every other part of our body. It wanted to be warmed up before it accepted content. It was a theory, and it turned out to be right. Think about it. If you're going to go run a marathon or do anything that's very strenuous, you don't just get up and decide to go run a marathon. You hydrate, you work out, you fill yourself up with, you know, certain types of foods. You know, there's a lot, you stretch, there's a lot of things you do in preparation. And in the same way, your brain wants to be warmed up, all parts of your brain. So Mike Mersnick came up with a suite of tools, and they're not like the Nintendo game tools. They're developed by a neuroscientist. I have nothing to do with the company, by the way, just in case you think that this is a sales pitch. No, I'm not driven by that whole economic super meme. But I will tell you that if you go to his website, you can use the tools very easily. They're really fun. They seem like a video game. But what's going to happen is when you start to play them, you're going to say, this is a really dumb game because it's too simple. And then all of a sudden, you're going to hit that cognitive threshold. And so you get a little positive feedback. So you're going to be playing, and you're going to get ding, ding, ding. Then you're going to get and then you'll say, this is a really stupid game. That's what happens. So I'm going to tell you about one game called Jewel Diver. Jewel Diver is very simple. It's three little fish, and they're all swimming around the center of the screen. And all of a sudden, a diamond comes up, and one of the fish hides the diamond. And it says, pick the fish that hid the diamond. And you go click, and you get a ding back. And then the three fish turn into five fish and two diamonds. And now one of them swimming out off the edge and comes back. And now it's seven fish and four diamonds. And they're swimming a little faster, and they're crossing over each other. Now, I'm not going to tell you what level you're going to get to, but at some point, you're not going to be able to keep track of the fish and the diamonds because they're swimming off the page and coming back up the bottom of the page and so on and so forth. And you're really going to get frustrated. Stick with it. Because there's no pattern to remember. It's not like regular video games where you go, the bad guy's going to come in with a machine gun from the left in about 4 minutes. You can't do that because it keeps resetting. So you'll hit a level where you can't do it anymore. Start it over again, and you'll get to another level. Start it over again, you'll get. Now, we have now given this game to 1 million children in the Oakland School District, and I think it's something like 2 million children in Jacksonville County for 4 years. All we did was give them the game to warm their brain up at the start of the school day. The children in Jacksonville County now have 3 times the academic performance of children that had no other change. If you and I think that things are hard right now, what do you think it's like to be 9 years old? You think that loading content might be kind of hard right now? To me, anything short of letting children warm their brains up before they start school is child abuse. We have these tools. We need to use them. In conclusion, the big discovery that I have made is that humans cannot progress faster than evolution will allow. Evolution is the gating factor, and we must come to terms with this because we're up against it right now. Our greatest challenges are not political. They're not economic. They're not even social. They're biological. Someone asked me to speak at a group of Egyptian leaders who had been part of the Arab Spring. And they said, we're having a hard time because we really believe that a change in government will change our country. It's our greatest hope. And I pointed out to them that when Mubarak took office, they're not big fans of Mubarak, but when Mubarak took office, the population in Egypt was, I don't know, 35 million, let's say. And 3 decades later, it was 90, almost 100 million. Mubarak would have had to create 3 times the jobs, 3 times the schools, 3 times the roads, 3 times the houses in that period of time while he was the leader. No leader in modern times has ever done such a feat. And yet it is easier to blame him than to blame population growth. Why? Because we're back to the whole Arnold Schwarzenegger problem. The one of the greatest drives that we have as humans is the drive to propagate. This is why, no matter what we do, we can't seem to get our arms around that primitive instinct. So it is time to change the conversation. We made a terrible mistake 154 years ago when Charles Darwin pointed out how slow evolution was. We decided to ignore it. And now we've got to introduce biology back into the discussion. Thank you so much for having me here today.
I'd like to remind our listeners that they're listening to Rebecca Costa at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco talking about The Watchman's Rattle, her book on a radical new theory of collapse. And now it's time for Q&A here. So we have time for several questions.
Q&A?
Yes.
They didn't tell me about the Q&A.
This is increased complexity.
I'm back up here for Q&A.
So
I should have talked longer.
So who would like to ask?
Would you care to comment on what people are calling the technological singularity?
I'm not sure I understand.
Okay, well, people have watched the progress of computer evolution and how it gets faster, cheaper, smaller, and there are some numbers that I don't recall mm-hmm. about how fast it's going. And the projection is that at some time in the not-too-distant future, the interconnectedness and the computing power is going to be so vast that it's impossible to predict what will happen with the computers all hooked up to each other and mm-hmm. Artificial intelligence being worked at in various labs.
I don't know if any of you are familiar with Dr. Ted Lewis at the Naval Postgraduate School. He did a book called Box Sandpile. Box Sandpile, B-A-K. It was a Swedish or Danish, I'm sorry if I get the nationality wrong, a physicist. And for many years, he sort of became legendary because he was building sandpiles, always the same way. He had hermetically sealed labs, and he was just dropping small amounts of sand because he wanted to build an algorithm for why sand piles collapse suddenly with no warning. And he built millions of sand piles, and they all collapsed a different way. Same moisture, same everything. He controlled every aspect of it. He could never get them to collapse. Sometimes he would drop sand, and there would be a little avalanche. Sometimes the whole thing would collapse. But what he knew is that with every grain of sand that he was adding, he was reaching criticality. And so what happened is they tagged every grain of sand, if you could imagine this, every grain of sand, and they started adding sand, and they noticed that every time they added sand, the sand was self-organizing in a really weird pattern, in a unique pattern every single time. There was no algorithm to be able to... But what he did know is that at some point, one grain of sand would either cause the pile to collapse, would do nothing, or would cause a small adjustment, but something would, or nothing would happen. And if you think about all the information we're generating, in 2 days since according to the CEO of Google, every 2 days we're generating as much information as we did from the dawn of man to year 2003. Those to me are grains of sand. Right? We have a problem. Computers can go faster, generate more data than is useful to the human organism. We simply cannot get through all that data. If I said to you tomorrow, pick out the essential facts from what was generated yesterday, right, to save civilization, you couldn't get to it. There's no computer that'll help you do that. So we have to understand that we're adding grains of sand to those piles. And every time we do that, we are subjecting ourselves to sudden collapse. This is how those of you that are economists know, this is how currencies suddenly collapse out of nowhere. When they do unravel, like in South America, it happens very quickly. And we're looking at that with the U.S. dollar right now. We really are. People don't really realize that we keep adding grains of sand. We're printing money. We're doing that. We're doing all those mitigations. Remember those short-term mitigations, water conservation? We're really good at mitigating and really bad at solving. So I would say to you, we've got to pull back a little bit and look at the environment we've created and the organism that has to live in it. And there's a departure that has occurred. And we have to bring biology back into the discussion. We need our leaders to face the fact that we are all overwhelmed and buried right now. And everyone is experiencing it. Everywhere I go, people feel they're failing. They know they're supposed to take care of their retirement. They know they're supposed to educate their children better, spend more time at home, eat more nutritional meals, exercise more. I mean, the list goes on and on of all the things you're supposed to be doing, and you know you're not doing them all, and you can't possibly do them all. And, by the way, I have a little video out that I don't want any more free applications on my computer. When you buy a computer now, you get all this free icons at the bottom, and I don't want those. And I don't want to renew them. And I don't know why I need antiviral software all the time and have to keep updating it because the stuff I have is too old. It's so complicated. And I also want them to make electronic gadgets that fit my thumbs. Fit my thumbs! My thumbs aren't going to change! Don't make those little buttons and those little screens where I look like I can't spell.
Thank you so much for taking the conversation in such a wide-ranging topic. We don't do this sort of synthesis or intuition very well in our society. What I wanted to draw you on was whether we've also been too reductionist in our definition of biology or the scope of material for evolution. Because with some of this computing technology and otherwise, we get to the point where perhaps the functional unit in a society or in evolution is no longer the human body, but the human body plus its connection to the net via a smartphone or so on, because there are so many people that say you're not socially functional without one. I try, but I admit I'm missing a lot. And therefore, whether we reach the point where reducing the definition of our identity, which is already, you know, many of us have more presence on the web than we do in our real lives,
yes,
is something that you no longer can say your meat body is sufficient to be human. And then you start getting into human rights of data access.
Well, think about all technologies. All technologies since the beginning of humankind have been extensions of our biological limitation, right? I can't walk from the East Coast to the West Coast, so we got horses to drag wagons, you know, and then from there we, you know, moved to trains, and then from trains, cars and airplanes, you know. Everything that we've ever developed has been an extension of our biological limitation. But now there's a price to be paid, because now we're in denial. You see, before we were connected to the land, and we knew we needed water, a basic thing to live. We don't know we need that anymore. In fact, I don't know where my water comes from.
Well, I'm a hydrologist, but yes.
But you get my point. We don't even actually think that we need to grow food, or we don't know where our food comes from. We're so disconnected from our biology, it's gotten really, really far away. So we're not worried about water. We're not worried about food. I had some guy say, you know, no, what you've got to do is you've got to buy a lot of gold, and you've got to put a lot of gold away. And I said, you can't eat that. And he goes, no, you can't. And I said, I'm telling you something. I am saving canned goods. You save the gold. And I bet I come out ahead with my canned goods. You want to see the world collapse. Your gold worth nothing. My canned soup worth a lot. So you know, we got to get real about it. You cannot eat gold. Gold will be worth nothing if there is a massive collapse. People don't want to hear that, because then our economic systems don't make sense anymore, right? And our models start to pull apart. Our models are already pulling apart. I'm not doing it. It's already pulling apart. So my comment to you is that there's a price to be paid. Now, let me give you an example, and people are kind of freaked out about this example. But Dr. Helen Fisher, do you know her? She's an anthropologist, and she wrote a book called The Anatomy of Love. It's a fantastic book. She went all around the globe, and she documented the 5 or 7 steps that humans show when they're mating. This man just had a date in the front row. He'd be very interested in this. It always starts with a gaze, right? You're in a public place or something, and you have a gaze, and it's slightly longer than you look at anybody else, and then you return to the gaze. Then after the gaze, you do something to call attention to yourself. You drop something, a drink, you make a loud noise, you talk loud or something like that to get that person's attention again. Then there's contact. You either go and talk, but you're going to break a physical boundary. You're going to say, let me help you with your coat. and your hand will gently touch their shoulder. If the woman doesn't flinch, she's giving you the signs. Keep going. Okay. So Dr. Helen Fisher documented all these stages, right? But the first stage is the gaze. Very important. In human copulation, the gaze has to happen first. The woman must give you permission. By the way, you men who don't know how to meet women, you need to memorize these stages because you need never be turned down again, ever, the rest of your life. My son thanks me for going through these stages with him. I used to run workshops for high school boys and never to get turned down, never ask a girl out that doesn't want to be asked out. Okay, why is this important? Very important. I got off a plane in Washington, D.C. I'm waiting for my bag, and what is everybody doing? You know what they were doing. What do you do when you get off a plane? You're on your cell phone. You're texting. No gaze. I walk to a restaurant. Everybody's on PCs. They're texting. No gaze. I happen to believe the cure to population control is going to be the fact that we don't gaze anymore. Population rates are going down in the United States. And you want to know why? Because using these gadgets is going up. We can logically figure it out. Forget birth control and Planned Parenthood. Give everybody cell phones and Blackberries and stuff like that. They'll never mate. They'll never mate. There you go. Extension. There is a consequence to where we're going in technology.
So I'm interested in this third problem solving called insight. And it brings me back to my little brothers, and I watch them interact with technology, and I see an intuition that I can't match. But I know I'm very proficient with technology. And I think about the times I have to tell my father how to do certain technological feats, and he's not very capable. And no matter how much teaching I give to him, he just can't pick it up. And so what I'm seeing is sort of like, and this also kind of ties into the idea of the grandchild's brain being larger, these increased rates of autism and ADD. What I'm seeing is actually, generally speaking, an evolutionary coping mechanism for all this information. But it seems to be an effective one because I'm seeing people who have the ability to interact with these complex devices on a level that is intuition, and it's almost beyond learning. And it seems to me like there's almost a solution in the works, evolutionarily, at least from what I'm seeing around me. And I also wanted to call attention to that diagram you showed of all the various types of information that are being added. And I only saw it briefly, but what I saw was a lot of information that seemed very unimportant, you know, pictures that are being added or, you know, new Twitter feeds. And these are things that I think that the mind can pass over. And I believe that information is being added, but I don't think that necessarily that information represents, you know, the important information and the stuff that is coming into play. And I think I can see a lot of children filtering through that and having the ability to interact with these devices beyond a level that I or maybe any of us can comprehend. What do you think about that?
I think, you know, I get asked about this. Where is the brain going? Where are children going? How is this affecting them? I get a lot of questions about autism and ADD and medicating these children when, in fact, this may be an evolutionary trend. And what are we doing by giving them pharmaceuticals and stopping that process when it may be a coping mechanism? I can't answer that question. And so finally I thought of a story I could tell to explain why, so you won't think I'm copping out. Can I tell the story?
Yeah.
It has to do with Henry Kissinger, one of my favorite characters. So Henry Kissinger was asked by Zhou Enlai, the first People's Republic of China's president, to come and talk. And Henry Kissinger knew that Zhou Enlai was a great student of European history. And so just to get the conversation going while they were having tea, you may have heard the story, he said, so what do you think about the French Revolution and the effects that it's had on modern society? And Zhou Enlai looked at him, and he was kind of confused. And so Henry Kissinger looked at the interpreter and said, ask the question again about the French Revolution's effect on government today. And Zhou Enlai turned around and he said, too early to tell. Yeah, evolution is a roll of the dice. We don't know. It's not organized. We don't choose how we're going to adapt. But one thing we do know is that the reason there are millions of types of fish and birds and social insects and lots of diversity and variety on the planet is so that when there's a sudden change, a sudden collapse, some will survive and some won't make it. And we don't know what that is. And remember that the environment that you're trying to survive now is a social environment, and it's moving very, very rapidly. And some of us, maybe it'll be the autistic people that survive. Maybe it'll be the people with ADD. Maybe it will be the linear thinkers. Maybe it'll be the only physicists. Maybe it'll be a world of only physicists. We don't know. It's just too early to tell. I hate to cop out on that, but it's just the truth. I think any biologist that were to try to predict the future is misguiding society.
All right, there's time for...
Really quick, do you think that optimistically you could use that view of... I mean, we don't know for sure if this is, you know, going to be good or bad, or what if this is even evolution taking place, but optimistically, couldn't we look at that as sort of a way to say that evolution isn't slower in that sense, that it actually is catching up or is making steps...
We don't know because we don't know what the environment is that evolution is driving toward. The example that I would give you is that, well, maybe this is autism is a coping mechanism. But then society collapses and it goes into a tribal mode. I didn't need that mechanism to cope. So you see, we can't bet on the future. I meant what I said. There's no facts about the future because it hasn't happened yet. So I love people that argue with me, no, this is going to happen. And I go, no, you don't know that. You know what I mean? So we just don't know. We don't know. We're all adapting. We know that. And we're all adapting differently. And some of those strategies will be correct. And some won't. No way to tell.
Partially that question is based on the idea that evolution is headed towards some place. And that's a popular idea about Darwin's idea, but his idea is much more we're all adapting and under certain circumstances some will survive and some won't.
There's no plan for adaptation. Yeah. You know, they're just it's not a planned thing, and we're not choosing and picking to adapt in a certain way. It's just a roll of the dice.
All right, so there's time for one more question.
I really should have talked longer.
I'd like to know what a sociobiologist is.
It's a good question. In 1976, Edward Wilson of Harvard University, he wrote a book called Sociobiology, The New Synthesis. I was an undergraduate at the time, just getting ready to graduate. And I was completely changed by this book. Effectively, what he was looking at is our behavior in modern society and how it's tied to our genetic inheritance. And that's what I do. I look at trends like economic collapse, like greed on Wall Street, like terrorism, debt, you know, why the country's in debt, why individuals accept debt. I look at all of our behaviors in terms of what was in it for our earlier ancestors and why those vestiges might still be in us, causing us to act in irrational ways. So I hope that's a good enough answer.
Well, it's an interesting part of modern culture is that the rich people are the thin one, and the poor people are the ones with the extra weight, you know, when it's excessive weight. And that's a totally reverse of what has happened before. So.
It is a reverse, but we don't know. If we have massive food shortages,
exactly,
the heavier ones will survive.
Exactly.
Right? And I will survive because I have canned foods, not gold.
That's a great way to end this. So thank you very much. Very good and entertaining talk. And that ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 110th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you.